Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome once again to my friends, to Voices of the Sacred Feminine, whether you're across town or across the globe. I'm Karen Tate, and tonight's musical offering that I was teasing you a bit with was Song of the Siren by Morgan Baum, and you can find out more about her beautiful music at sacredhands.org. Thank you for being with us during this very busy holiday time. I can just imagine you out there helping the kids with homework or wrapping the holiday packages, maybe getting some of your cleaning or cooking done while you're listening to the show. So my sincere thanks to you for choosing to spend your time listening to Voices of the Sacred Feminine, and I promise you won't be disappointed. This week's show highlights the work of two special women, both Gaias, who care deeply about Mother Earth. At the top of the hour, we have Nina Simons with us. She's a social entrepreneur and co-founder of Bioneers, an organization I want to make sure you definitely know about. It's based in Northern California, and it's trying to find breakthrough solutions for people and the planet. Nina's going to discuss Bioneers and her new anthology book, Moonrise, The Power of Women Leading from the Heart. Topics we'll delve into will concern women's leadership and restoring the feminine in us all, as well as the ingenuity and strategies of Bioneers to ignite and inform leadership for a sustainable future. Then, crossing the threshold to the bottom of the hour, something I've never done here on Voices of the Sacred Feminine, because, you know, this show isn't a show where we're after sensational stories or ratings or something like that. But tonight, I do have what might be a serious expose of what's happening where I grew up, in the region around the Gulf Coast, where the BP oil spill has just wreaked havoc with countless lives and the environment. We have an environmental and political activist and investigator, Anita Stewart, with me on the show. She's calling in from Florida, and she's going to be discussing some pretty disturbing stuff that many say is happening all along the southern coast of the United States. And I got to warn you, this stuff sounds like conspiracy nut job stuff, but it's coming from credible people and lots of them. And there seems to have been some sort of a media blackout. I mean, when was the last time you heard anything in the mainstream news, really, about what's going on in the Gulf, except please come down, you know, eat the seafood? Well, Anita is going to fill us in on sick residents and some other just crazy stuff, oil-eating bacteria that's being developed by BP that they're not sure what the environmental hazards might be. People are talking about a crack in the seabed, black helicopters, sick residents. You know, something seems to be happening down there in the Gulf, and I'm just worried that the American people are being kept in the dark. Now, Anita describes this as something going on between BP and the government and the military. It's like something off the sci-fi channel, and if some of this stuff is true, even a little bit of it, it might be one of the biggest conspiracies in our history. I mean, I feel funny even letting these words roll off my lips, but, you know, I would rather take a chance and say it and be wrong than not talk about this stuff, because this will affect the lives of millions of people and Mother Earth for generations to come. So stay tuned and see what you think. You make up your mind. I'm reminded of what I said last week. The motto of our show could be, because, you know, we're here trying to rethink how our world can be. You know, we don't want to just tinker around the edges. You know, we want to talk about women's leadership and, you know, right brain thinking and all of this stuff, which is to a lot of people new, you know, new cutting edge ideas. And, you know, it you know, makes some people a little fearful. So we've sort of adopted a couple new mottos for the show here, two of them that, you know, you out there seem to really get a kick out of. And I have to admit, I kind of identify with a little bit, considering how the sacred feminine has been swept beneath the rug. So the first one is, all truth passes through three stages. First, it's ridiculed. Second, it's violently opposed. And third, it's accepted for being self-evident. That's from a 19th century German philosopher, author Schopenhauer. And then the other one from Gandhi, I believe that's who spoke these words. First they ignore you, then they laugh at you, then they fight you, then you win. So I don't know, I that just came back to my mind this week when Anita and I were talking about whether or not we were going to discuss this stuff on the air. So anyway, we're going to take a shot at it. Some new developments before I get to my first guest tonight. Turns out Blog Talk has sort of told all the hosts at the last minute that our airtime is no longer going to be free. Last year it's been great because they provided us this platform free of charge so that all of our wonderful guests would be able to share their work with the world, and it didn't cost me anything except time and effort, but you know, as you know, it's my guilty pleasure, so I really didn't mind. I love doing this. But now it's going to cost us a minimum of about $30 to $40 a month. So we're looking for a sponsor or even a few people who might commit to helping us pay for the show to keep us on the air. Admittedly, it's not a lot of money. But, you know, once they start charging you, no telling, you know, where that's going to go. I'm hoping that you folks out there, if you like Voice of the Sacred Feminine, you'll help support us. Because remember, like nature teaches us, what you tend to nurture and nourish, well, that thrives. When you neglect things, it withers. So here I am sounding like PBS on a fundraising drive. Please support us to keep us on the air. If you're interested, please contact me at KarenTate108@ca.rr.com or send me a message through my show page or through my website at KarenTate.com. And please be sure to remember the three F's. Yes, the three F's. You see them on the my show page when you pull up the show. I'd love it if you would mark Voices of the Sacred Feminine a favorite. That's the first F. Be sure to become our friend and click on follow. Those are the other two F's. Favorite, friend, and follow, so that you never miss notice of who my new guests are going to be each week. And that way you're a part of our growing family of listeners across the globe. And finally, please remember to tell your friends out there that my website with the link on it is now up to the sacred tour I will be leading to Turkey next November for men and women. We'll be going to places like Istanbul, Ephesus, Şatıl Hayık, Side, Lagina. We'll be doing activities like Turkish baths, partaking of mineral baths, rituals at the sites, dream incubations, meditations, lots of fun stuff. So if you're hearing the call for a sacred journey to satisfy your mind, your body, or your soul, well, just go to my website, KarenTate.com, and you can figure out all the details. Feel free to email me if you like. We will only take 20 people, men and women, so don't hesitate if you think you might want to secure your place on the tour, because believe it or not, it's already filling. All right. If you're out there listening and you would like to call in and speak to either of my guests tonight, please do so. The number is 718-766-4662. I know most of you listen from the archives, but if you want to call in, when I see you on the switchboard, I'll identify you by your area code. And when we have a natural lapse in the conversation, I'll invite you to give your comments or questions. So, I want to thank our first guest, Nina, for her patience, and start out by saying hello. Hi, Nina, calling from Hawaii.
Hi there, Karen. I'm delighted to be with you. And well, terribly impressed that you're First, I just want to express how excited and enthused I am about Anita Stewart. What a great guest, and how courageous of you to feature her work.
Well, you know, like I said, there's a tad bit of nervousness about it, but you know, if there's even a little bit of truth to what she's going to say, it's huge, you know. And
well,
that's where I grew up my entire life. I know how the people down there, you know, the seafood industry, the wetlands, that's their culture, you know.
Yeah.
That's such an important part of the United States, and it's really scary, the stuff she has to say. And she's a credible person, and some of these other people are very credible people. And if what she says is going on, we really need to know about it. And it's I don't know, scary stuff. So,
well, I appreciate your courage in featuring it. Thank you.
Well, and thank you too for all the work you're doing. You know what? Let me not get off track, because I want to make sure I read your bio to folks, so they have an idea who you are and all the work you've been doing out there in the world. And then I want to talk about your wonderful organization, Bioneers, and your book, because you know, Bioneers, that's you're out there on the cutting edge of trying to change the world for Mother Earth and humanity. It seems like it's in sync with what Anita is going to talk about later, you know, as well.
Yep.
Here's your short bio. Nina Simons, co-founder and co-CEO of the nonprofit Bioneers, an organization that since 1990 has identified, featured, and disseminated breakthrough solutions for people and the planet. She co-facilitates Cultivating Women's Leadership Retreats and was previously president of Seeds of Change and a strategic marketing director at Odwalla. She edited the recently published Moonrise, The Power of Women Leading from the Heart. We're going to talk about all of that stuff. And what I really, it really touched me. And 2002, Nina produced a retreat for diverse women leaders called Unreasonable Women for the Earth to envision a broad progressive women's movement with environmental restoration at its heart. The gathering served as an incubator, resulting in the formation of Code Pink, Women for Peace, and I just love uppity women, so they're right up my alley. And she's won all sorts of awards and distinctions, one almost every year for years. Rainforest Action Network's Revel Award for helping build an integrated progressive movement at the crossroads of environment and social justice. Named Utney Reader Visionary for her leading-edge work in communication, community building, and ethical commerce. Just one award after another. So we are thankful and honored that you would be on the show and give us some of your valuable time, Nina.
Oh, my gosh. I'm delighted to be visiting with you all. And the truth is, you know, those awards stymie me as much as anyone, because, frankly, Karen, I feel like I'm just putting one foot in front of the other, like we all are. And it did lead me into an interesting inquiry about what does it mean to be acknowledged as a leader, and why do I have such a conflicted relationship to that word?
Well, you know, I think we're so busy doing it, we don't think about it much. You know, we're just doing it, and suddenly, you know, people realize we're doing it, and, you know, maybe they're glad you're doing it because they wouldn't want to be doing it. And,
well,
I
think many of us are really reinventing what leadership looks like now.
Yeah.
And I know that for myself, and just as it sounds like for you, Karen, I don't do what I do to get acknowledgement or for rewards or for financial compensation. I do it because it's in service to what I really love.
Yeah.
And I think that, you know, when you do that, then when you get acknowledgement, it has a whole different quality and flavor to it than if you're out there for the glory, you know. And
well, if you were sitting across from me, you'd see this big old grin on my face. I get it.
I know you would.
Well, you know, that seems like a perfect segue then. What do you want to talk about first? Do you want to tell folks about Bioneers, or do you want to talk about how the book came to be?
Well, I can do both. Why don't I talk about Bioneers first and then give you a chance to check in, and then I can go on to the book if you'd like.
Okay, let's do it, because, you know, I want to make sure I mention to listeners, in case we get engrossed in the conversation, there are wonderful YouTube clips of speeches given by keynote speakers that have appeared on Bioneers, on YouTube, I believe. And, I mean, you could just sit there for days and listen to these brilliant people and just be in awe. And you know what? I think more than anything else, feel hopeful. Hopeful that, you know, that we are going to have a future and we are going to see the light at the end of the tunnel. But please, Nina, go ahead. Tell us, what is Bioneers? How did it come to be? All of that good stuff.
Well, Karen, thank you for saying that. I think there are clips on YouTube and on Vimeo, and also, I think, through our own website, bioneers.org. You know, I came to this work in a very unexpected way. I actually grew up in New York City, and I was the daughter of two artists. And so I first fell in love with theater, and I just assumed that the arts were how I was going to make a living, because I really saw that really the landscape that most needed to change was the landscape that lay between people's ears and or between their heads and hearts, and that arts have a tremendous capacity to help people question their own belief systems and really transform how they see the world. But I also grew up really loving nature. And so, let's see, the way that I first got into Bioneers was actually this. I had moved to New Mexico, which is actually where Bioneers is based, and met the man who was to become my future husband and partner, named Kenny Ossibel. And he was invited to go and film at a very unusual garden in southern New Mexico. And so I went with him to film this garden, not having any idea what I was in for. And we got to this beautiful area where we got out of the car and were invited for a tour through a biodiversity garden that was being cultivated by a master gardener named Gabriel Howard. And unbeknownst to me, I was entering a garden unlike anything I'd ever seen before. There were hundreds and hundreds of varieties in close cultivation with each other. And as I walked into it, I realized that it was one of the most beautiful things visually I had ever seen. It was just a riot of color and shapes and sizes. And there were whole societies of tomatoes, you know, of every shape and color. And they were all warming in the noonday sun in New Mexico. And Gabriel invited us to taste things as we walked through the garden. And so I found myself sampling these amazing, unusual herbs, things like lemon licorice mint and chocolate basil. And there were sunflowers that were about 7 to 9 feet tall. And they felt like they watched us as we walked through the garden. You know, they had heads like 18 inches across. And it was wild. And there were things, this was in 1989, and there were things I'd never heard of before back then. Things like a rare heirloom variety of amaranth, which is the high protein grain of the Aztecs. Mm-hmm. And it was called elephant head amaranth, because it grows in the shape of an elephant's trunk rearing up into the sky, and it's got these gorgeous scarlet seed heads.
Wow.
And quinoa. I mean, just gorgeous, gorgeous stuff. And as we walked through the garden, and I'm sampling, I'm tasting things, I realized that my senses were just dancing, that between the sights and the smells and the tastes, it was just glorious. And then Gabriel started introducing us to each plant as we walked, and he would introduce us by the Latin name and the common name, and then he would explain how it was related to all the plants around it. And I began to realize that this man knew these plants better than a lot of people know their own families. And then he started explaining to us how this magnificent diversity of amazing food sources was under threat, and how because corporations were gobbling up all these little seed companies, there were fewer and fewer of these amazing varieties available to people out there, and how serious a threat that was to our food supply.
Right.
Right? And I began to wonder whether a garden like this might have actually been the inspiration for the Garden of Eden.
You know, you're saying that, you know, as you, 10 seconds ago, I was thinking they're walking through Eden, but I didn't say anything because I didn't want to interrupt you. But yes, yes, absolutely.
Well, that's what it felt like. And I was just in so much awe and such huge personal delight at all this that hearing about the threat really moved me. And by the time I walked out of that garden, I felt as though the spirit of the natural world tapped me on the shoulder and said, "You're working for me now."
Right, right.
You know, and I was terrified because I didn't know anything about farming or gardening, and I thought, "No, you've got the wrong girl." You know, I don't know about this stuff, but it was an unmistakable call, and so I went back to Santa Fe where I lived. And I quit my job at the Santa Fe Chamber Music Festival, and I went to work for the company that my husband Kenny and Gabriel co-founded, which was to become Seeds of Change, which was a biodiversity organic seed company. And soon after that, Kenny came to me with the idea of starting a conference because he was a journalist, and he had been researching and discovering that there were all these amazing people out there with phenomenal and effective solutions for our most challenging environmental and social challenges.
So, Nina, is the problem that they're not getting the word out simply because people like Monsanto have too much money and influence and, you know, they're just sort of taking over? I mean, for I don't know how else to describe it.
Well, I think you mean the problem with the seeds or the problem with the leaders or the solution?
I guess maybe all of it, you know, the fact that, you know, there seems to, or, you know, maybe it's just that I'm starting to become more aware of it, but I know the genetically modified food that's out there,
right.
And,
right.
You know, and it seems like, you know, they're trying to get Congress to pass laws so that, you know, little farmers are at a disadvantage, so,
yeah.
You know, so it makes it harder for people, I would imagine, like the company you're talking about, to stay in business and thrive because laws are going to potentially maybe, you know, put you out of business and the little guy who sells his food at the farmer's market out of business.
Right.
It feels really scary that we're all going to be eating genetically modified food, and who knows what that potentially is going to do to our bodies and you know, the food supply on the earth.
Yeah, you're right, Karen. You're absolutely right, you know. But there isn't a simple answer to your question. I believe that the most honest answer is that we're at a crossroads where our old ways of doing business are crumbling and corrupt and falling apart in big chunks. And I think the government isn't really working very well to the people's health and safety. And I think corporations have largely run amok. And I think that we are at a moment where, as you said, really our challenge is to reimagine what it means to be human.
Right.
And to reimagine how to live on Earth in a way that can protect the sanctity and well-being of ourselves and our future generations.
Well,
because it is all under threat.
Well, and I know you talk to brilliant people all the time, so this might not be a new idea to you, but I heard this economist talking on Democracy Now! Recently, and he was talking about how we have to start thinking about the difference between growth and development. You know, we've been all about growth, 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 because we're all about greed, 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 rather than realizing that you don't and can't keep growth going forever, that you have to get to the point where you start thinking about development. And he gave a perfect example. He said, you're maybe only going to grow to 5'5", and you're going to stop growing, but that doesn't mean your mind doesn't keep developing, you know? So I thought that was a wonderful analogy because it just seems like we're, you know, we're pressing the limits on everything, you know, and we've just gone beyond, and it's time to stop the growth and start the idea of development.
Well, I think that's exactly right, Karen, actually. And I think, honestly, we've gone beyond many of nature's limits. And now we have to find what equilibrium looks like and what it looks like to invest in our own communities and our own self-reliance and our own resources so that we can co-create the future we want. Because, frankly, as long as we allow corporations and the government to dictate what future is going to look like, it's not looking very good. Frankly, I think there's a giant call to leadership for us all.
Well, and it is scary. I mean, I know I talk to people who say, well, yeah, you know, you and the folks on your radio talk about change, but, you know, we don't hear a lot in the way of solutions. You know, it's not like we have a template out there and we can just say, okay, well, plan A isn't working anymore. Let's just switch to plan B. It's like we have to learn this as we go, I think. You know, we're at a different place in our evolution than we've ever been.
Well, I think that that's true, and that's a lot of why we started Bioneers in the first place. So we started it in 1990, and every year we bring together people from all walks of life who have created new solutions for what have seemed like impossible challenges.
Mm-hmm.
And what happens, Karen, is that when you hear the stories of these people's solutions, you realize, well, if they can do it, so can I. Because a lot of them are just folks who said, I'm passionate about this, and so I'm going to stand up on behalf of what I most care about. You know, that gathering of women that resulted in Code Pink really was inspired by a woman from the Gulf Coast, a fantastic woman who's a fifth-generation shrimper from the Gulf Coast named Diane Wilson. And Diane Wilson, when she discovered that her county in southern Texas was the most polluted county in the country, she got on fire. She just decided she needed to rise up in defense of her kids and in defense of this bay that she had grown up loving. And she educated herself to be able to file legal briefs and do direct actions, and she started fighting against the corporations who were polluting the bay down there. And she actually was successful against several large multinational corporations. So she was the one who really inspired that gathering of women.
Right,
and that's what
right.
I mean. You know, you hear these stories and you realize, holy cow, she had a high school education. And if she can do that, so can I.
Absolutely. It's, you know, David and Goliath. Well, and I think, too, you know, you have so many people being brainwashed that this whole idea of global warming and everything is just an Al Gore gimmick to make money, you know. I mean, the cynicism out there, you know, and the ignorance out there is really just unbelievable. And I'm just as worried that, you know, how do we overcome that problem as well as the corporations? Well, I mean, I know that's part of the corporate propaganda, you know, their dollars feeding that. But, you know, the fact that half the country, I mean, I'm making a gross generalization here, but, you know, I think the people who listen to Fox News, in a sense, you know, they're not sure, you know, that global warming or any of these things are real. I wonder if they even know about Monsanto or, you know, any of the things that we're concerned about, you know?
Well, right. And, you know, I think that that is a big concern. And each year they do a national survey to assess the level of environmental knowledge of people in the U.S. And what they find is that pretty consistently people in the U.S. score 2.2 correct answers out of a total of 10 questions that they ask. And here's the really scary thing, Karen, is that random guessing would produce 2.5 correct answers. Okay.
Oh.
So,
well,
you know,
I'm sure you probably saw circulating around the internet the University of Maryland put out the study that, you know, the Fox News listeners are the most uninformed you know, listeners in the United States. And you know, that scares me to death. I feel sorry for those people, quite frankly, you know. I mean, not only are they holding the whole country back, in a sense, you know, they're voting for people who will hold the country back. And, you know, and just for themselves, you know, they have to be full of fear and just in the dark. And, you know, I know what that used to be like. That's my background, you know, before I awoke, so to speak. That's just the easiest way to say it. You know, I used to live in that environment. And, you know, I don't know, I guess I just feel like if there was one wish I had for the world, it would be that, you know, we could all wake up one day with a, you know, a little bit more awareness of what's going on around us, you know, as if, you know, I don't know, a fairy could wave her wand or something. I'm being silly, and I digress.
But you know, I think – I think in relation to what you are saying, Karen, one of the things that I really believe is that we can all strengthen our capacity to connect across differences. And one of the things that they have found, they did a study in Kansas that was very interesting about people who didn't believe in global warming. And what they learned was that those people considered it part of their identity to not believe in global warming. Like, you know, that meant that they were good, God-fearing Christians, or that they were anti-abortion or anti-global warming. And once they actually took it out of that jargon and decided to meet people at where their real value systems lay, what they found was that the people in Kansas really care about thrift, and they really care about self-sufficiency. And so when they said to them, well, wouldn't you be interested in renewable energy sources that saved you money and that helped decrease our dependence on foreign oil, those same people said, yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, so it's sort of like when they take the polls, it's all in how you ask the questions. So it's really you approach the subject. You know, your audience, you know, there it is.
Well, and find common ground instead of digging in to try to change somebody's mind.
Yeah, well, and you're right, because some of the latest stuff I've heard about, you know, the folks who don't believe in global warming are saying that, you know, something along the lines of, well, you know, Jesus wouldn't let it happen kind of a thing, you know. I don't know, something like that. That's not exactly right, but it's something like they really don't have to worry about it because, you know, it'll all take care of itself kind of a thing. But that's right. Yeah, I mean, finding common ground is so vitally important, I think, whether we're talking about politics or religion or anything. And, you know, because we certainly need to stand shoulder to shoulder, I think, considering how huge the obstacles are out there and the challenges. That's, you know, at least I see it that way.
Well, and I think part of the solution lies in exactly what you're doing, Karen, is citizen media is spreading awareness and other voices, you know, and I think the reality is we can transform each other's capacity for leadership by hearing each other's stories and by sharing the stories of solutions that already are out there. Because as soon as you know how many brilliant, amazing solutions are out there, it helps you believe in your own capacity to affect change, and it helps you see the world, as you said, in a more hopeful but still grounded way.
Right. Well, now, let my listeners know a little bit more about Bioneers, because I know you do a conference every year, but I'm not sure what you do the rest of the year. And also, tell us some of the more hopeful, you know, people you've met or ideas that they have that are actually making a difference.
Okay. Well, Bioneers does a lot of things. So we do have a conference each year that's based in California, but it's also beamed by satellite and on the internet. Last year, there were about 20 communities all over the country that had Beaming Bioneers conferences, and you could also get it on the internet. We also produce a radio series that's free to any radio station anywhere in the world, and it's award-winning, and it's currently on about 300 stations, reaching a potential audience of like 100 million people, and it's phenomenal radio, so please ask your local radio station to carry it. And we also produce trainings and books. So there's a whole book series, of which Moonrise is the latest, and a very strong element around women's leadership and restoring the feminine, which I think are two really important ideas for us all to be dreaming about and strengthening our own capacity through. So let's see, some of the stories. Why don't I just tell you some of the stories of some of the women who are included in the book, Moonrise, The Power of Women Leading from the Heart.
Sounds
Would
perfect.
That help?
Absolutely.
Because okay. Many of those women actually spoke at Bioneers conferences, and so I had this opportunity to read through literally hundreds of stories and realize which among them were the most powerful in sort of opening new possibilities for me and really inspiring me into new kind of pathways for my own leadership. And one of them that I love is a woman named Judy Wicks. And Judy was a single mom in Philadelphia, and she opened a muffin shop to help support her and her kids. And when the muffin shop was successful, she started growing it into a restaurant. And Then when the restaurant started being successful, she realized she really wanted to use it as a community place for education. And so she started bringing in speakers, and a couple times a week she'd have speaker events while people were having dinner. And then she started leading tours around the world, and she would bring groups of her customers to go visit the organic shade-grown coffee cooperative in Ecuador that she was buying her coffee from. And then she realized that if she was going to serve meat in her restaurant, she really wanted it to be organic and humanely raised. But she couldn't find sources for all of the meats that she needed for her restaurant. So she started using the proceeds from her restaurant to start funding organic ranchers and growers so that they could produce organic and humanely raised meats.
Wow.
And then when she achieved that, she went around to all the other restaurants in her neighborhood in Philadelphia and said, well, I don't want to have a competitive advantage. I want you all to use organic and humanely raised meats. So she wound up like leveraging every success into a larger and larger venue. And since then, she's gone on to co-found an organization called the Business Alliance for Local Living Economies. Because
wow.
She realized that small businesses really are an amazing engine to create change.
Well, and, you know, as you're telling this story, I'm thinking about one of my mentors, Rianne Eisler, Chalice and the Blade, mm-hmm. Real Wealth of Nations. She always, you know, has taught, from the beginning, it's partnership. And that's what I hear this woman did. She created these incredible win-win situations, you know, partnership, not trying to put the guy down the street out of business so that they could all thrive. And, it gives me goosebumps because, I mean, that's what it's going to be about in the future instead of this dog-eat-dog survival of the fittest stuff.
Exactly. And I think, I think one of the silver linings of this economic downturn that we're in is it gives us all an opportunity to really examine what does real wealth mean. And
right.
Frankly, I am just increasingly convinced that it's all about relationship and community and the web of connectedness that we're all a part of. That's
right.
What really creates resilience, and that's what creates real wealth.
Well, you're reminding me of another story that I heard, and I want to share. I want you to keep sharing yours too. But this sort of piggybacks on what we were saying. This woman in a third world country was supporting her family making shawls, and she was able to make, I think it was 2 shawls a week or 2 shawls a month. I forget which. Well, this company came in and said, well, we can help you, do better, make more money for your family. Here's a machine to help you make the shawls. They give her the machine. They come back in 3 months, and, they ask her, well, how are you doing? Well, she's still only making 2 shawls a week or a month, whatever it was. And they asked her why, and she said, well, I want to have more time with my family and my community. two shawls is enough. imagine enough, it doesn't have to be, excess. Enough is enough.
Well, that's exactly, just as you were saying earlier, I think we are challenged at this moment to learn to live with what Bill McKibben calls a romance of limits, because nature survives and thrives because she has limits. And unlimited growth leads to cancer. And
yeah.
That's what we're seeing as a civilization. And that's where, as you said, it's time for development, not growth.
Right, right. Well, and even the ancient Egyptians, their whole thing was about balance. If things weren't in balance, then you had chaos, and they were scared to death of chaos. And
yep.
Other semantics, we're describing the same thing, but there's no moderation anymore. Things have just gotten so out of balance, and the result is chaos. So tell us about more of these wonderful women in the book, in the title.
Okay.
Again.
Moonrise,
The Power of Women Leading from the Heart.
Right. And the book actually has 3 men in it, but it's got about 40 really wonderful, inspiring stories of all kinds of women and men making change. And modeling leadership in very different ways than we've been accustomed to think of it. Another one of my favorites is a woman named LaDonna Redmond. And LaDonna is a woman from an inner-city, low-income neighborhood outside of Chicago. And she was working in social services and had two small children. And one of her kids started having these life-threatening allergic reactions. And he was only like 2 years old, and she was terrified. And so, you know, he would eat something, his face would blow up like a balloon, he'd start gagging, they'd race him to the hospital. And eventually what they discovered was that he had terrible food allergies. And so what she started learning then was about how to prepare healthy foods for him so that she could keep him from being sick. And what she discovered was that in her inner city neighborhood, it was easier to buy a gun or a bottle of malt liquor than it was to buy a fresh tomato.
Mm.
And so she hit on this idea of what's being called now food deserts, because there are many low-income communities all over the country where it's really hard to get healthy food. And in fact, a lot of the businesses that have grown up in those communities have grown up to take advantage of people's needs rather than to support their greatest health or flourishing. And so she has started, creating farmers markets in her community where food stamps were accepted for payment. And she brought in all these growers from the surrounding area and started connecting up people who were looking for healthy food with the growers who, of course, were working to produce it. And now she's working on creating a chain of cooperative healthy food stores for inner-city low-income communities. And so she's really, you know, it's one of my favorite quotes from Gandhi, actually, since you quoted him at the beginning of the show, and I'm going to paraphrase, but basically he says that when you take personal experiences and give them public voice, they become political.
Yeah.
And that's really what LaDonna did, you know. She transformed her own personal experience into an innovation that can be for the good of people all over the country.
Wow.
Yeah.
Well, Nina, we have, I think we might have a caller here. I'm going to check and see. Could be they have a question, could be they're just listening. So I'm going to go to the person on the switchboard with the 760 area code and unmute you. Hi, caller. Did you have a question for Nina?
Hi, my name is Sarut. Hi, Karen. How are you?
Oh, hi. I recognize you. Thanks for calling.
Well, I just wanted to really not have a question, but I'm studying sustainability right now at St. Louis University. Mm-hmm. And, of course, I'm very interested in this topic. And I am wondering if Nina can repeat the city she was in Mexico.
Ah, you know, our organization is based in New Mexico.
Okay,
so it's
New
state
Mexico.
Of New Mexico. It's actually in Santa Fe. And I'm excited that you're studying sustainability. If you go online to bioneers.org, I think you'll find all kinds of information there, as well as some free downloads and such.
Okay.
But is there something else that you wanted to ask about?
Well, I just wanted to leave the audience with two things I learned in sustainability. One is that within the next 20 years, if the world doesn't do something and make different strides and choices, it will require two Earths to support the way we live. And the other one is that if everyone in the world lived like we do in the United States, it would require five Earths.
Pretty astounding.
Point. Yeah.
Yes.
And, you know, it's interesting because what I would suggest to you is that that's exactly why I believe that the goal of sustainability isn't enough. And I think it's not enough for a couple of reasons. One is that, you know, sustainability is simply the midpoint between
yes.
restoration and destruction, right? And we've
That's
already
right.
damaged so much that we actually need to help restore the Earth's fertility.
That's
right.
Right.
Yeah.
Exactly.
So I am so with you. And
there are
some
really interesting innovations that are going on with ecosystem services right now, and some of these aftermarket services from nature. Like, for example, there's one company in Canada that is taking this corrosive element that used to clog up a lot of the water waste system piping, and they're taking that those nutrients out of before it gets a chance to corrode onto the pipes, and they're using that and introducing it back into the agriculture industry for slow release fertilizer. So there are some interesting things coming down the pipe to help us to be more sustainable.
There
and then
sure
beyond,
are.
As you said. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I couldn't agree more. And I think one of the most promising areas, actually, that you may want to explore a little is the area of biomimicry, which is about how
right.
we can learn from nature systems, you know, the things that nature has developed through 4 billion years of R&D.
Yes, I just finished architecture school, and we were looking at, you know, we were looking at different building materials, and biomimicry was one of the organizations that came up in my lead class.
Oh, fantastic. That's wonderful.
Oh, yes,
well,
it's excellent.
Really
well,
excited
thank you.
For what you're
thank
doing.
You. Well, thank you so very much for calling in. We have about 15 minutes left on the show. Did you have another question?
That's it. I just wanted to say keep up the good work.
Well,
you
thank
too.
You. Thank you for calling in, Sarood.
Okay.
And
bye-bye.
We need you to redesign all of our systems and our buildings, so thank you.
You got that right.
There you go. Keep our future. Bye-bye, Sarood.
Okay, thank you.
Stay tuned in.
Okay.
So, Nina, I want to make sure we don't skip the portion of the show where you talk about the power of women leading from the heart. What does that mean exactly? Beyond these, you know, just these wonderful individual stories, how is it that women lead differently?
Well, I think it's not only women, but I do think that women are really modeling new forms of leadership. What I discovered, Karen, as I was reading through these hundreds of stories, is I discovered certain commonalities among them. And one of the things that I just want to mention also is that when I started getting awards and acknowledgement for my leadership, you know, I think I may have mentioned earlier that I had a very conflicted relationship to it. And for the last 5 years, we've been offering these 5-day trainings called Cultivating Women's Leadership. And when we first started offering the trainings, a lot of women would call us up and they would say, well, I'm really interested in kind of going deep with a group of engaged, committed women, but I'm not so sure about this leadership thing. And so we started realizing that actually it was more than me that had a conflicted relationship to leadership. And what I realized is that as we did the trainings and we started asking each group of women, so what does leadership mean to you? I think we've all inherited a model of leadership that's largely motivated by greed or a desire for celebrity. It's often been modeled by people who tend to work in a very single-focused way and have no work-life balance. They often sacrifice themselves for the good of the project, and they often become targets because they stand up on behalf of something that they're leading. They also often lead through some combination of dominance or aggression. And frankly, neither me nor any woman I know aspired to that kind of leadership.
Yeah.
And what I realized when I started really reading all these hundreds of stories was that none of these women or the men who had been my greatest role models fit that mold. And instead, so rather than being motivated by, you know, greed or a desire for celebrity, actually almost all of them are motivated by a desire to protect and care for something that they are most passionately love or feel committed to.
And isn't that that's right brain thinking, you know, in action.
Well, it's also leading from the heart rather than the mind.
Right.
You know, I mean, we've often been taught that the mind is more powerful, but even Einstein said the mind is a powerful servant. If you make it the master, you're in deep doo-doo.
Yeah. Well,
and actually, our hearts, you know, Native American cultures have long taught that actually it's a balance of heart and mind that really informs wise leadership.
Well, and it feels, too, that it's about valuing ourselves not by our bank book, but by maybe being in service. You know, it's sort of just a different set of values or benchmarks.
Well, it is, and part of what's exciting to me, honestly, Karen, is that if my own life is any kind of teacher to me, what I found is that stepping into your own assignment is the most joyful path of service you can possibly find. So instead of being all about self-sacrifice and driving yourself into the ground, it's actually a kind of leadership that's revitalizing, that's
mm-hmm.
renewable, and that's restorative. And that's
yeah,
what
keep
we
putting
need.
Yeah, gas in your tank.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. It's totally renewable.
So in a way, it as we stumble through this process of trying to save humanity, it's almost as if we're reinventing leadership, showing a new way of being leaders in the world.
Well, I think that we are, Karen, and I also think that, you know, because we're all products of a patriarchal culture, what that means is that we've all grown up with a certain bias that says that those human attributes that have been attributed to the masculine are good, and those human qualities that have been attributed to the feminine are not good.
Mm-hmm.
And we all need to recover from that because, I mean, I do think this has a correlative in terms of right brain and left brain thinking, like you were saying, right? I mean,
mm-hmm,
what
yeah.
I started realizing for myself is that those parts of my contribution that are about arts or aesthetics or relationship or conveying emotion are not of lesser value than those that are analytical
right.
and fact-based, you know, even though we've all been taught to think of them that way.
Well, you know, and I get in trouble sometimes for saying this, but I can't help it. I believe it, and I'm not sure I've come up with a better way of saying it, but they complement each other. It's a partnership. It's like yin and yang, you know. Separately, you know, they can stand on their own, but together they're an awesome couple.
True, and here's another way to say that. Since we just had a lunar eclipse,
mm-hmm.
right? We live on the only planet we know of where the sun and the moon can appear the same size in the sky. It's the only planet where an eclipse is possible.
Wow.
Doesn't that seem like instructions to you?
Yes, that's
does
awesome.
To me.
I didn't
yeah.
know that.
Isn't that great?
Well, so now the book, how did, you know, I'm sure, I mean, obviously, you know, you can read between the lines, and I get that this really helped you emerge as a leader as well. You know, talk a little bit about that, and, you know, how did you choose from all of these different stories?
Well, you know, first of all, I should mention that if folks are listening and they want to check out the book, there's a section of it that's downloadable on our website. So they just have to go to bioneers.org and then search for Moonrise, and you'd find sections of the book that you can read. You know, part of what I found, Karen, was that I was once given the assignment to write my relationship to bioneers. And what I wrote was that I had this story that I was the woman behind the man. And in my inner story, I was supporting my husband's vision. And honestly, when I saw that that was my story, I felt kind of nauseous. And I realized that it wasn't anybody else's story. It was only my story.
Right.
It wasn't how he saw me. It wasn't how anybody else saw me. It was only me.
So you could change that.
Well, exactly. It was like discovering that I had the keys to my own liberation. And really what I set about to do was to unpack my old story and develop a new story for myself. And I did that largely through learning from other people's stories. and through developing a whole series of inquiries and practices that could help me learn to value my own assignment and to value the particular uniqueness that wanted to come through me. And what I found was that the way that women and men are reinventing leadership at this time is we're leading from the inside out. And so the way the book is designed, it not only tells stories about my own leadership process, but it also has five sections that really invite readers to explore their own leadership from the inside out. So from what gives your life a sense of purpose and meaning, you know, to how do we share new discoveries like that Judy Wicks story I was telling you about? How
right.
do we mentor each other and grow each other's capacity? And then the last section of the book, which is the section that has men in it, is really about how do we restore the feminine to our institutions and our culture in a bigger way? Because I believe that as women, the particular relational ability that we have both biologically and culturally encoded in us is exactly what the world really needs right now to advance the leadership of new ways of being.
Well, and it's almost, I mean, like, you know, people like you and I, we sort of eat, sleep, and breathe this, so it's just normal for us. But I remember when Hillary Clinton was, you know, running for president, and you would interview women from other parts of the country, and they'd say, oh, no, I don't think I can vote for a woman. We're too emotional. I wouldn't want her hand on the red phone. And I'm thinking, you know, we have a lot of rehabilitation, in a sense, or education, reprogramming, if you will, to do about what the feminine is. You know, so many people think it's, you know, this, oh, the vapors, you know, this, you know, emotional women, you know what I'm saying.
Well, I do. And one of the big discoveries for me has been to recognize that actually my body doesn't lie to me. And when I feel something emotionally, it's a way of my getting information. It's a way of this biological creature telling me something I need to know. And that's very different from what our culture has taught us about emotionality.
Yeah. Well, you know, we've been taught for how many years to be disconnected from our body and nature, and, you know, that's when it all went wrong.
Well, exactly. Well, one of my very favorite quotes in the world comes from the physicist Fritjof Capra, and he says, the key to transforming our society into an eco-literate society, one that knows how to live in right relationship to the natural world, it involves a shift from a focus on counting things to a focus on mapping relationships.
Mm.
And I believe that that's, as women, one of the tremendous capacities that we have to offer.
Well, absolutely. And I think in the process of us figuring out how we're going to save the world, because the Dalai Lama says we're going to, you know, I think Western women also have to figure out how we're going to do better at supporting one another as well, because sometimes we have a problem with that, unfortunately. But,
well, you know what? There's a tremendous payoff in learning our way through it, honestly. It's one of the biggest things we've learned from doing these leadership trainings, is that when you can get a group of women to authentically and honestly and wholeheartedly show up in support of each other, we have such a tremendous capacity to grow each other. And
you know,
that's
I know
one
you're
of
right.
the most exciting resources we've got.
You know what? I know you're absolutely right, because I've experienced both ends of it.
Me too.
Nina, you have been wonderful, and I want to thank you so much for being on the show. Our time has already flown by. I can see Anita is on the switchboard waiting for me to get to her. So the last thing I'd like to ask you before we say goodnight is what thought would you like to leave our listeners with?
Well, that if we can believe in the value of our heart's yearnings and trust our bodies and minds and spirits to inform our path forward, we can become unstoppable.
Oh, I like that. Nina, you are a wonderful way shower. You are just awesome. I hope to one day get up there to a Bioneers conference. And please give the website again and the name of the book.
You bet. Thank you. So if folks would like to, please go visit our website. And if you give us your email address, then we'll stay in touch with you. And that's www.bioneers.org. And as Karen said, if you go on to YouTube or Vimeo, there are all kinds of free downloads you can check out. And the book is called Moonrise, The Power of Women Leading from the Heart. It's available both by book and by Kindle. And if you're interested in learning about our women's leadership trainings, please email us at women@bioneers.org. Thanks so
Wonderful.
Much, Karen.
Thank you so very much. It's been a pleasure to have you on the show, and it's a pleasure knowing you, Nina. Keep up the good work.
Thanks so much. You too, Karen.
Good night.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Well, listeners, if you're just tuning in, this is Karen Tate, hostess of Voices of the Sacred Feminine, where we discuss Goddess, the Divine Feminine, and the resurging interest in right brain thinking and the feminine consciousness. And as I like to say, whether the great she, whether you consider her deity, archetype, or ideal, and how these new values and benchmarks just will save the world. You've been listening to Nina Simons of Bioneers. We thank her for her work in the world. She's certainly a Gaia. She's an inspiration and a way shower. And now I am going to turn my attention to my other guest here. We're crossing the threshold into the next part of the show. And we are about to invite Anita Stewart on. Anita, are you there? Okay, I don't think I unmuted her yet. Anita, are you there?
Can you hear me now?
Yeah, I can hear you now. Can you hear me okay? Okay, one more time. Are you there, Anita?
Yes.
Okay,
can you hear me?
There you are. I see the right image on the switchboard. I think we're good now.
Okay.
Well, Anita, thank you. Thank you so much for calling in. Before we start our chat, because it's very important, I want to just read a little bit about you to our listeners so they have a sense of who you are and all the work you've been doing out there in the world in your lifetime. Anita Stewart, she's a licensed medical professional. She's an artist, a writer, a blogger, photographer, a new media and virtual outreach expert. She's a U.S. Air Force veteran, and she worked as an intelligence operations specialist in the United States and Europe. She studied English, film, poli-sci, and journalism in college, and she's worked with the Tampa Bay Veterans for Peace, Code Pink Tampa Bay, and the Tampa Bay Indie Media Collective. Anita was one of the first organizers for Hands Across the Sand, which is a global initiative to stop offshore oil drilling and promote energy alternatives. From 2006 to 2008, Anita was on staff for two presidential campaigns for Dennis Kucinich and McKinney. Is he Green Party, Anita?
Yes, Cynthia McKinney ran for the 2008 presidential candidate.
Oh, okay. I'm sorry. I didn't realize it was a Cynthia. It was a she. Okay.
Right.
Anita has also organized for the Green Party, and she works hard to change the course of our country by reforming our media and electoral processes and by organizing voters and promoting candidates that are not corporate-owned. Soon she'll be attending an urban permaculture design class, and she was recently elected to the Hillsborough County Soil and Water Conservation Board, and that's in Tampa, the Tampa area in Florida. Interesting, Anita, Nina Simons of Bioneers, you and her have something in common. She was there at the beginning when the Code Pink people sort of gestated the idea to start the organization. Isn't that funny?
That it's kind of like connections. There's always a connection.
Yes,
and, you know, it's a small world, too, when, you know, there's so many of us trying to change the world. At some point or another, we were connected in some way, either a person we knew or an organization that touched us or we touched them or
Absolutely.
Somewhere along those lines.
Yeah, serendipity at work. It, what is that, 6 degrees of separation?
Right, exactly.
Well, I don't know if you were listening at the top of the hour, but I'm going to sort of repeat a little bit of what I said. What we're going to talk about, this, I guess the best way I can describe it is a tell-all, expose, whatever. And, you know, normally I don't do stuff like that, you know, because we don't have to go for sensational stuff or ratings. We just talk about what we think is important. And this is certainly important. But it has that, you know, sort of salacious expose feel to it. But you know what? It scares me to death not to talk about it because, as I said at the opening, if this is true, we are in serious doo-doo. You know, because, like I believe you've said, there's been what you believe is a media blackout among mainstream media about what's going on down there in the Gulf.
Oh, exactly. They consider it a non-story. They've moved on to other things, and, you know, as we know, I believe you know, I know, and many people that have been studying media or been a part of it, we have a corporate-controlled media, so only what the corporations who lead us, that news gets out. The real stuff doesn't get out.
Right, yeah,
and the
distractions, the bread and circuses get out, but not the stuff that, you know, we really need to know to make decisions for our lives and our politicians.
Exactly. So that's what's happened in the Gulf from the get-go. The media was controlled, and, you know, they're still doing it to this day. And to this day, the oil is still coming up on the shores. The core exit is still being sprayed. The people are becoming sick. This is not a story, you know, in the mainstream media. It's definitely a story in, you know, the independent media. And all of this sounds so like it's a conspiracy theory, like it's an urban legend.
Mm-hmm.
If it wasn't so true, it would, you know, the fact of the matter is it's true.
Well, you know,
what's happening?
Well, at the opening of the show, you know, it's funny that you're on now tonight, because just 2 weeks ago I started mentioning these mottos, you know, that I thought would sort of fit just sort of the work of the voice of the sacred feminine. You know, I mean, how many people, you know, don't even know that there was a goddess 40,000 years ago? So it's this huge revelation, you know. And so,
right. So
by virtue of the fact that, you know, we're talking about these right brain, you know, goddess, divine feminine kind of ideals, these mottos that I was talking about were things like Gandhi, who said, first they ignore you, then they laugh at you, then they fight you, then you win. Or this other, you know, 19th century philosopher who said, all truth passes through three phases. First it's ridiculed, second it's violently opposed, and third is accepted for truth. So, you know, that's sort of the context I put tonight's show in, because this might sound like, you know, just craziness, you know, something that you might see in a sci-fi movie, or, you know, how, you know, people look at people when they talk about UFOs, you know. But this is, credible people are saying these things, right, Anita?
Yes, well, we've basically been together throughout the Gulf. The main four states that have been affected were Louisiana, Mississippi, Alabama, and Florida. And we've band together and networked with each other, so we have very vocal people in each of these different areas, and they've become their own media. They're taking pictures, they're documenting, they're attending these made-up forums, which are just, you know, forums basically. Well, I'll give you an example. We had a forum here in St. Petersburg back probably about a month and a half ago called The Science of the Oil Spill, and it was put together by the Sierra Club. Now, most people think that the Sierra Club is an environmental organization, and by all outward appearances, they are, but they, too, are controlling the information on this. So there were three professors that were up at the front talking about the science of the oil spill. And it went on to many, many different facets, the plumes, how far the plumes go, what a wave is, relocation of sea turtles, everything except the human impact of this catastrophe was discussed. At the very end, they asked questions, and the first question, I mean the audience, the participants, asked questions, and the questions were taken up, written on 3x5 cards, taken up and then presented. So nobody could get up and speak. The information was controlled. The questions were cherry-picked and selected. Hmm. The first question that was asked of these professors was, do you work for BP? We might as well get this question out of the way right from the get-go. All three of them sat there and lied. We have it on video. Because as soon as I got home, I got right on Google, and I Googled BP contracts with University of South Florida. I pulled up a PDF file of the current studies that were being funded with the money included and the ones that were projected.
So because I said at the forum they weren't BP employees, but here they were mouthpieces of the Sierra Club, and they in fact were BP employees.
Yes. Well, they were professors at USF, but their studies are all funded by BP.
Funded, right, yeah.
So okay. Anything that you're getting from, you know, anything that you're getting from the intelligentsia and the professors and the scientists is controlled. Anything that you're getting from the mainstream media is controlled. And BP has even given money to our local TV stations down here so they can promote tourism. Come on down, eat the seafood. The seafood's fine. I want to let people know right from the beginning. We have independently tested shrimp down here. Just shrimp. That was just one type of seafood. And independent tests are continuing. But it came back as 193 parts per million.
And what does that mean?
The FDA and the CDC, who should be ordering mass evacuations and be concerned about the health of citizens with, you know, compromised immune systems, they should be working. They should be testing the seafood. They're picking up maybe two fish and sniffing them. Now, what is the real matter here is the fact that we don't have just oil we're dealing with down here. They literally are carpet bombing the Gulf with a chemical called Corexit, which is the dispersant, of course, which the mainstream media spoke of, which is highly toxic. And when it mingles with the oil's there, it just sinks it. But then it morphs into something else, which is even more toxic.
Now, Anita, I want to ask you something about this. I remember when the oil spill first started and Rachel Maddow went out to the Gulf, I seem to remember hearing her say something about the fact, about this Corexit, number one, that it has been banned off the coasts of England, you know, BP's home country, and it is more expensive of a dispersant and a more toxin dispersant, but yet they're still using it, and it's a BP product. So is that all true? So BP is getting paid to use their more toxic chemical in the Gulf.
Exactly. The BP BP had the accident with the oil, whether it was an accident or whether it was what they call crisis. I think they have a term for it. It's called crisis management, where they create the catastrophe and then they spend them. Then they can actually clean it up. And each time they're making money.
Yeah, it's called either disaster or crisis economics. It's like when Halliburton goes in.
That's
Halliburton goes in and destroys a town, and then they get paid to build it up in a war. You know, it's like they get paid on both ends. Yeah.
Exactly. Now, there are three distribution centers right in Louisiana for Nalco, and anybody can Google those and get their addresses. I can't remember the towns offhand. I remember Scott, Louisiana, has a Nalco distribution center, but there's two others that are there. But yes, you're exactly right. Rachel Maddow was exactly right when she said that. that the, and they're using two different types of the Corexit. They're using what's called Corexit 9500 and Corexit 9527. And, you know, the 9527, they're both toxic. So they're supposed to say that the 9527 is less toxic, but, you know, they have strict rules on letting the ingredients get out on these two items. And the other thing that wasn't mentioned was Corexit is banned not just in England, but in 33 countries.
Wow.
Because of the toxic levels.
Well, if we said nothing else, if we just stopped right here and didn't get into the rest of it, it seems like there's, and this is just my opinion based on what we're talking about, it seems like there's alleged gross negligence on the part of the government. Because how could they possibly, I mean, how could they have not stopped BP from using the Corexit? How come they're continuing to let them use the Corexit? If it was only just that, but I mean, there's so much more to even talk about.
Well, in the very beginning when this happened, I had written an article and I posted it on my blog. It was called More on the Oil Gush. And if you Google that, you'll find More on the Oil Rush, Oil Gush, More on the Oil Gush, sorry. And that was one of the items that I mentioned in the article was the fact, how could our government be so negligent to allow this to happen? But then when you look at how the oil industry has been continuing for decades. This isn't something that can be blamed on Obama. This isn't something that can be blamed on Bush. The oil rigs have been in that area of the Gulf since the 1940s. And if another website that's really handy, you can go to opensecrets.org and look up energy, and you can see which politician, which representative took money from big oil. And I can tell you right now, after looking, I don't see any representative or politician that has not taken money from big oil.
You know, you think when something was this big, you know, I mean, it's almost immoral. It's unbelievable to think something this, this huge. I mean, this isn't just a minor little scandal. I mean, this, you know, this has repercussions. You know, we're going to get into that. But this has enormous repercussions. I don't know how they expect to keep it under wraps if all the things we think are going on are going to happen, you know?
Exactly. This has, right now, the people that are actually living on the Gulf, I moved inland about 30 miles back in 2006, in February of 2006. We had had the four hurricanes come through this area of Florida and through the Gulf, and Charlie was a near miss to the Tampa Bay area. In fact, the track for Charlie was going right through Tampa Bay, and I lived right on the bay. And finally, I just had a vision, and I had had the vision ever since 2001, that there was going to be something wrong with the water. It was either going to be a tsunami or a huge hurricane was going to wipe Pinellas County out, which they have showed static maps of that, where if there was a 20-foot storm surge, literally, Pinellas County, Florida, which is Clearwater and St. Pete, would be underwater. And I started to have dreams and visions of something going wrong with the water, but I never was able to see what.
Right.
So I moved, me and my significant other, he and I moved into Zephyr Hills, which is inland and on very high ground, and it's where they also bottle the water. Somehow there's always been a connection with me and water. But that's where they bottle the Zephyr Hills spring water. There's huge springs there. Anyway, when we moved, I still kept having these visions. When this happened on April 20th, this was it. I mean, this was the thing that I knew was, I mean, I knew right away that my visions coincided with this particular event. And that, like I said, those were the first questions I asked. Why is our government not stepping in? In my personal opinion, our government should have stepped in BP charter, and once they revoked the BP charter, taken them out of the picture, and then had our own people doing the cleanup.
Right.
You know, or the military or whatever. But yeah, what's going on now? Yeah, what's going on now is BP to clean up their own mess. And we have allowed them for all these years, decades and decades, to operate without oversight. Even their plan that was filed, it was a cut-and-paste job from the Exxon Valdez plan. They were talking about walruses.
I remember that. Rachel Maddow exposed
that.
Yeah.
As long as they had a plan and it was filed, our leaders didn't read it.
Yeah.
They just chucked it away somewhere.
Yeah, it could have been some kindergarten homework.
Yeah, we pay them to conduct oversight on these corporations. So, you know, we pay them to represent us. We pay them to protect our environment. So now we're not even talking about animals at this point because most of them out there are dead or almost dead.
Well, and
there was a dead zone.
Well, and remember, you know, there was a media blackout. They wouldn't let you see the animals either, you know, just like we don't see the coffins coming home from Iraq and Afghanistan. It's all controlled, what we see is going on. Well, let me just quickly get to a couple things. Talk about the seafood first. I mean, if all this, I mean, look, I come from the South. I know the oysters sit at the bottom. I know the shrimp are at the bottom. The catfish are at the bottom. The crabs are at the bottom. If the Gulf is full of oil sitting on the bottom of the ocean, I mean, at the Gulf, I mean, it's just common sense that if these animals live, they've got to be sucking up all that poison, and then we're going to turn around and eat them? I mean, am I making this oversimplistic, or is that just logical?
No, you're right on. I mean, the whole thing is based in logic. I mean, you have bottom feeders like shrimp and oysters and all these other, you know, seafoods that come out of the Gulf, and these fishermen can either fish or starve.
Right.
And some of them have stopped fishing. Some of them won't do it anymore simply because they do not want to take the risk of being sued. They actually had to sign some paperwork, some of them, that if they continued to fish, that they were going to be held liable if anybody was sick, not BP.
Well, and I think listeners have to think this through and connect the dots, because if you're a restaurant down there, or you're a hotel down there, or you're a fisherman down there, you need the propaganda coming out of that area to be positive, or you're going to lose your business. Even if you're a homeowner down there and you live close to the Gulf, you don't want people to think the land is poisoned so you could never sell your house and move away. So unfortunately, it's this sort of, I don't know what better word to use, and it's almost like a predator situation where they're desperate, you know, they're between a rock and a hard place, so they can't really tell the truth unless they're going to lose everything.
Exactly, and BP's even paying for a lot of the advertising. So we see the advertising all the time. You know, we see it from, you know, come to the Mississippi coast, our seafood is great. They show the parks, they show a seafood buffet. This is all advertising that's being paid for by BP. So BP is paying for all this advertising instead of cleaning up, because that's another issue.
Right.
They're spending millions of dollars in this advertising, and they're trucking in sand so they can cover up the oil that's on the beach.
Well, that's like when, you know, any of the oil companies do these commercials pretending like they're a friend of the environment. What a joke. You know, it's the
same
stuff.
Yeah, they're not a friend of the environment. And this is just, it's like the most serious black op that you could ever imagine. Anything that you could read in an espionage novel. I mean, BP is richer than God. They can truck in sand and create a clean beach and cover up everything. And then the people come. Yeah, the people come. They sit on the beach. Their babies play, you know, dig holes on the beach or make sandcastles, and they're in the toxins.
Right,
because just under the layer is the oil and the toxins, and you don't have to see anything for it to be contaminated, because the Corexit is colorless and it doesn't have an odor, unless it's mixed with the oil, of course. But
well,
when
you know
it's
what
on
I'm
its
wondering,
own,
What I'm wondering, Anita, and I don't know the science of this. I'm not pretending to be a scientist, but remember when it was in the press that BP didn't want the people cleaning the beach to be seen by any media wearing respirators or the gear that would have protected their skin from the from the chemicals. I mean, if they needed respirators and all of that, like you're saying, just being out there breathing it. Touching the water, maybe even rain. I wonder about that. I mean, just being in the environment, do you believe that's unhealthy? Do you think when it rains, just sort of the natural cycle of how things, that circular cycle that, it's going up into the clouds, it's coming down, and, it's covering everything with poison.
It's third grade science. This stuff is going to, what the dispersant does is it breaks down the oil into little tiny microscopic globules, and this gets evaporated and goes up. There's so many people in the Gulf region right now sick. It's in our air. It's in our water. It's everywhere. It's in the rain because, we're having fall here, down here in Tampa, Florida. I've got leaves outside that are falling off of trees. We don't have fall in Florida. There's leaves all over the place outside of my apartment complex, right outside my window here.
So what do you mean by that? What connection are you making that it's affected the weather?
I'm making either the connection that the pH in the soil is off because of the rain that we've had,
okay.
Or the rain is actually coming down and burning the leaves.
Okay.
I've never seen leaves turning colors. I have outside of the patient where I work, outside of my patient's window, there's a tree that's red. The leaves are all red. I've never seen anything like that before here.
So, Anita, just playing devil's advocate here, because I'm trying to think, well, what are my listeners thinking as they're hearing us talk? I can understand BP's money keeping a lot of people quiet, but how can the doctors that are seeing these patients, how can they stay quiet?
I'm not sure about that. We have some doctors working with us. I'm going to note two organizations here. One is called Testing the Water, where we promote individual testing of the sand, of the water, of the air. There's testingthewater.org. We also have a Facebook fan page. The other organization is called the Gulf Coast Barefoot Doctors. The Barefoot Doctors were health workers that worked during the Chinese Cultural Revolution while they were under communism. They didn't have hospitals out in the rural areas, and people that were experts in different modalities would go out into the urban areas and provide medical care for the people that were in need. And some would be hospice workers, others would be midwives or acupuncturists. Well, basically, we stole the name from them, Barefoot Doctors, and this is headed up by Delia Labar, who lives in New Orleans. And she basically started to put together detox kits for the people that became symptomatic and started getting sick. And we are in the process of becoming a 501c3. The paperwork's all been signed, but what we would like to do is have people doing that in all of the affected states. Detox is the only way these people are going to survive. And I'm going to tell you why, because as people become symptomatic, as they're breathing it or they're in contact with the water or whatever it may be, it could be through the air, symptoms may not show up for 6 months, a year, 2 years. We have one basically model that we can go after, and that was Dr. Ricciott's account of what happened to the workers after the Exxon Valdez up in Alaska. Her book, Not One Drop, documents those different things that happened both politically and with the people themselves and their medical. And most of those workers that worked up there at the Exxon Valdez are dead. And they died of various different diseases brought on by their exposure to the toxic chemicals.
Well, I want to mention real quick. Well, I want to mention real quick that she was on the show here on September 1st. She was at the bottom of the hour. So any of the listeners who want to follow up this interview, I mean, you know, listening to our interview, Anita, with the Ricky Ott interview, just go to my archives to September 1st, and you'll be able to hear a lot of what Ricky Ott said, which what you're saying tonight. But before we run out of time, Anita, let's get to the more startling stuff, because we haven't even touched on that. Because you were talking about the black helicopters, it looked like it's a joint BP government military operation, that the depopulation theory that people have, that Jesse Ventura has on videotape, why don't you address some of those? I mean, those are the really bizarre, scariest shit stuff. Crack in the seabed.
Exactly. Well, when this first happened, there were a lot of different takes on what was happening in the Gulf, and what was amazing for many, many people to see was the fact that the security was locked down right away by the Coast Guard. So since when does our military guard a corporation? When the hell did that happen?
Right.
You know, all of a sudden the military is not guarding our coastline, which is their mission. They're guarding a corporation with more money than God, you know. And that blew my mind. But in any case, when that was all happening, we had a very outward spoken person who had been in the oil industry all his life. His name was Matt Simmons. He and several other different scientists had, and even Senator Nelson of Florida said that they had all looked at the evidence, and it led people to believe, and led them to believe, that there was a crack in the seabed floor, that they did something down there underneath the water in deep waters that they could not fix.
And they don't want us to know it.
And they don't want us to know it. Exactly.
And the oil is still flowing then. And so does that mean that you think the oil is still flowing?
Yes, I do.
Okay.
Because there's too many eyewitnesses that are seeing it, people that I'm speaking to directly, not hearsay, but people that I speak with, you know, on a daily basis. The other thing is the Corexit operation, which has just blown my mind. Right now, our media and our government has said that there has been no Corexit sprayed since July 19th. It is a lie, because there's been pictures that have been recovered from a toxic waste dump that incidentally was put right next to a Native American powwow site. It's a sacred land. Right next door to this, they put a huge dumping ground of old Corexit canisters. And somebody was at the powwow and got pictures of what was going on in that dump. And as she was taking these pictures, there were labels on these Corexit canisters that very clearly said delivery date, August 20th, for instance. I'm just thinking of one in particular.
Right.
And that would clearly have been a month and a day after supposedly they had stopped using it. So they're lying. Now, the other thing is, I have pictures, and so do many other people, that there's, you know, the C-130s are flying out of Stennis Air Space Center and several other military installations in the Gulf region. So the Nalco trucks are dispensing from those three locations in Louisiana to the airspace center and to other places. Military, that's the only way they can provide security, is if this is done on a military base. They can't do that with a civilian airport. And then these C-130s and Blackhawks are spraying this stuff everywhere. They're taking off and spraying it. And for a part of this summer, Dar Jamal reported on it. They were also getting the yellow and white canisters, putting those on what was called these Carolina skiffs, and they were going out in the water and spraying the water right off the skiffs.
So what you're saying, that, I mean, tell me if I'm connecting the dots right. Because we think potentially this oil is still flowing, they're still spraying the Corexit to hide that fact. And didn't you also say that you thought they were spraying Corexit on the land because of this depopulation theory?
Yes. We have had people actually out in their yard that's been sprayed. And then the next day they were in the hospital because of the reactions. We also have a possibility of people getting bacterial infections from these spraying incidents as well. I've had people tell me that there's been whole hospitals up there loaded down with people that have infections that are close to MRSA, but they can't be treated.
What does that mean, close to MRSA and can't be treated?
Well, what these bacterial infections do is they actually mimic what MRSA is, and MRSA is it's a very, very bad infection that for some reason a lot of people that are incarcerated or in hospitals get. It's similar to a staph if it's not staph.
Okay.
But in any case, they can't cure this particular thing that's mimicking the MRSA, and these people are possibly dying, but they're being diagnosed as something else. This is what's going on with the doctors. The doctors are seeing all these different symptoms. They're not putting them together. They don't want to put them together. And they're saying, okay, you have bacterial pneumonia or you have this. Well, all of these things, when you put them together, are the same symptoms that Dr. Ricky Ott spoke about in her book.
Okay.
Not one drop. So everybody's being misdiagnosed pretty much.
Well, and you also led me to a website about BP now is creating some oil-eating bacteria. I guess what, to eat the oil off of the floor of the Gulf, and they don't really know what the environmental effects of this bacteria could potentially be.
Exactly. And that's what's called the Cynthia, Cynthia, or the blue plague. One of the symptoms that people are getting in the Gulf, and one of the reasons they're calling it the blue flu or blue plague, is because they are actually suffering from lack of oxygen. So just like a senior citizen that's on an oxygen tank, you know, because of a lack of oxygen, they're getting blue lips or their fingernails are getting blue, you know, and that's what their body needs is detoxing and definitely oxygen. And they're not getting it. Sometimes they're using 10% of their lung capacity or
right.
20% of their lung capacity because they're not able to breathe in. They're not able to take a deep breath because there's no oxygen in the air. It's toxic.
Right,
and,
right.
Dr. Ricky Ott, again, she spoke about some of these things as well. I got to meet her personally when she came here on June 22nd to speak to the fishermen, and there was not a single media person here to question her. Not
That's
a single one.
It's unbelievable. Well, what do you think about wasn't there just something in the news in the last week or so that the Justice Department is filing suit against BP?
I think that's all smoke and mirrors, and I don't think the people of the Gulf will ever see that money. So all those people that have lost the fishing industry, lost the tourist industry, that, you know, a lot of them have lost their homes, they're not going to see that money. And,
well,
yeah, I definitely do believe that, you know, if Katrina didn't hurt these people in the long term, this will definitely do it.
Well, and the thing that you told me that made sense was one of the reasons that the people in the area are keeping quiet about it potentially is because, how did you say it, when they aren't out fishing, BP employs them, right? So they can't really bite the hand that feeds them.
Yes, there's a lot of people that have done both jobs for a long, long time. It's you know, the petrochemical industry in Louisiana and, you know, especially South Louisiana has been there for a super long time. And many, many of those people have done both jobs. They've fished or they've worked administrative for BP. And then they've gone out and fished when it was season, you know.
Well, you know, it reminds me when they were talking about Wall Street, you know, when they said the banks were too big to fail. It's almost as if, you know, BP is too big to fail. I remember reading part of the reason potentially, you know, maybe the United States couldn't be harder on BP was the fact that so many pensioners over in Britain depend on their, you know, BP, you know, their stock and their, you know, BP pensions and all of that stuff. So it's like if BP went down, it would be like a domino effect. It would affect, you know, so many other people. I mean, not that, you know, I guess if I was one of those pensioners, I would feel differently, but it's almost as if, you know, this is just too huge, especially if part of this equation we're talking about, and we haven't gotten to this yet, but if this oil starts to affect the climate, do you want to explain a little more than that? Because this is going to go beyond the Gulf.
In July, well, it probably already has. In July, a nuclear physicist, I can't recall his name right now, he wrote a report in Italian about the loop current and the Gulf Stream and how the loop current in the Gulf of Mexico was broken. And if that was true, then it would affect the Gulf Stream all the way up into Europe, because it would literally bring on a very quick and sudden ice age. Well, people are wondering now what the heck is going on in Northern Europe, including England, because they've had record-breaking cold temperatures. People have died. People are stranded in the airports right now because the flights can't go out. It's just unprecedented weather patterns. So now people are starting to say, okay, was this report true?
Right.
Yeah, it could have been. You know, the gentleman, Matt Simmons, that I mentioned before, Matt Simmons, who was one of the ones who thought there was a crack in the seabed, he died in his own hot tub, and many people think he was suicided in his hot tub.
Now, who was he again? I'm sorry.
He was a huge guy in the oil industry. When this first happened, he started to do some videos. He started to do some interviews. He was very outspoken about how they possibly did something down in the bottom of the Gulf that they couldn't fix. And he had made the comment that the seabed floor was cracked. And what was mysterious was the day he died, which was last summer, but I can't remember the exact date. He was on an island in his summer home off the coast of Maine. And he either had a heart attack in his hot tub, or he drowned in his hot tub.
Bizarre.
Or it was both.
Yeah.
That just sounds too much like a espionage novel to me.
Tell about the Swan Doctor, too.
The Swan Doctor was a man here that lived very close to Tampa Bay who was an expert in swans and veterinary medicine, but especially swans. He was like world renowned. The Queen of England used to fly him over just so he could take care of her swans.
Do you remember his name?
And Dr. Gardner.
Okay.
And he worked with his son, and he had an office in Lakeland. So I have a girlfriend who's a political blogger here, and she's worked for several different local and national campaigns as well. She, too, has worked for presidential campaigns. But anyway, she's a political blogger locally. And she knew that the same time we found 173 parts per million in a sand sample off the coast of Sarasota, that was September 22nd, that same time frame, people that were in that area in Sarasota working at a wildlife rescue brought all the way to Lakeland, I don't know how many swans or birds it was. It was quite a few. One died upon arrival, but they wanted him to test them and find out what was wrong. They had exhibited some symptoms of paralysis. Well, you know, they probably weren't oiled, but they probably inhaled Corexit, but there's no way of knowing that. But Dr. Gardner said, okay, I'll put together a report. And at her urging, he was promising her a report, and she kept calling and kept talking to his son. Well, he's really busy right now. The report's almost finished. Oh, it's finally finished. It's sitting on his desk, but he can't talk to you right now. Take a message and have him call you back. Well, it was the first week of November. She happened to call, and I remember because I had just been elected, and she called the office, and the number was disconnected. And literally, this Dr. Gardner and his son have fallen off the face of the earth. Nobody knows where they are, what they're doing. He was 49 years old, so there's no way he retired. But in any case, nobody knows where the report was. All of his cases were fielded out to other local veterinarians, and we never got the report.
And he was about to release information that you think was going to
exactly.
be damaging. Yeah.
Exactly, exactly. And the thing about it is I don't know if you're familiar with Sarasota, but Sarasota and this part of Florida, we don't have as much summer tourism as we do winter. Our winter from November to April down here is the height of tourist season in this part of Florida. And we have many people both internationally and people from up north and Canada and Michigan, Maine, all the northern states. All these people come down here. Some of them even own homes here. So for this information to come out before a major tourist season, well, you know, they definitely didn't want that out. But the big question remains, what happened to Dr. Gardner and his son? Where are they? What are they doing? And nobody can contact them.
The other thing I'm thinking about, too, is, I mean, if somebody wanted to find out more, I mean, if we're, all right, you know, we talk about all the time, you know, our media is owned by corporations and, you know, they tell us what they want us to know, not what we need to know. Can people get any information, like, say, from BBC News, or is there anybody talking about this and maybe Americans just aren't hearing it?
The best coverage that we've been getting lately has been from Al Jazeera, the English Al Jazeera. France 24 has done some interviews. Dar Jamal, who writes for just about everybody, Truth Out, for himself, for Al Jazeera, he's written some great exposés. There's a lot of blogs out there. You can go to my blog at WhoDude at Blogspot.
You better
then,
spell that.
H O O D O O E D .blogspot.com, and I post pretty much everything that I think is pertinent to what's going on now in the Gulf. And the other one is Florida Oil Spill Law is really good. And I can really just, if I could encourage people to donate to testingthewater.org for independent tests. The tests are costly. And now we've found out that a lot of the chemists and labs have probably been compromised. So we're going to be needing to send these tests to Canada to get accurate readings. And then the other thing, the other website is the Gulf Coast Barefoot Doctors, and I'll spell that out. It's www.g, as in Gary, C as in cat, barefoot, docs, D-O-C-S, .org. Or if you put in a search, Gulf Coast Barefoot Doctors, it'll come up. We have a Facebook fan page and then the website. The website has protocols for detoxing. So that's our next move, is getting people together that actually can provide health care, whether we be doctors all the way down to home health care aides, people that can help the sick, because we have a feeling we're going to have a lot more sick down here.
Wow. Anita, this is, well, I want to make sure before we go off the air that we tell listeners about the Jesse Ventura video, because that, I want to say to listeners, you know, when I first saw it, it sort of comes across a little hokey, a little sensational, but remember, Jesse Ventura, you know, forget about his wrestling days. He's been a Navy SEAL. He's been in Congress. You know, he was really loved by the people of his state. I forget now which state he was governor of. You know,
I think it was Minnesota. It was
Minnesota.
Or Wisconsin, one of the two. I always get those two mixed up. But,
well, you know, yeah. he has this show now. You can Google it. Do you recall the name off the top of your head? I should have looked.
Yes. Yes, it's on True TV, and it's called Conspiracy Theory. And he's done the exposés on just about everything, 911 and Plum Island. He's done some really, really good shows. He did one last week about the BP spill. And whereas I would have liked to have seen a lot more of the locals interviewed, I thought he did a good job with the time frame that he had. And I hope that he does more shows on this topic. I don't think there's any way it can be covered in one show.
Right, right. Yeah,
he did a fantastic job, and I think we really need to start talking about the sick and the symptoms now.
Well, and he had someone on the show who said that he has brown stuff coming out of his ears.
Yes, that was David Arneson. His wife, Kendra Arneson, has been one of the loud, very vocal people. Her husband, David, is a fisherman, and they are from Venice, Louisiana, and her home happens to be the closest one to the water, actually geographically the closest one to the well itself. So she's been contaminated and sick as her children and him. He's been very ill as well. He's a lifetime fisherman. She actually was getting ready to open up a restaurant when the well happened, and she also was hired by BP and worked for them for a short time before she became a whistleblower when she realized what they were doing.
Yeah. Well, I would highly recommend looking at Jesse's video. You can actually see it on the internet. That's where I saw it. And because if you're a visual person, the impact of watching what he's presenting, it has more of an impact on me sometimes than just hearing people talk. And he also, in that show, got into the subject of depopulation, that it looks like there's a theory out there that they are literally trying to depopulate that part of the United States so that it ends up in the hands of the petrochemical industry.
Yes, that is pretty, it actually looks like that because, we had Katrina, and we know that those levees didn't hold. And that was not the fault of the people, that was the fault of our government. So, there became a diaspora after that where people were just moved out. Some have come back, but most of the people that would like to come back can't afford to ever come back. Now we have this instance 5 years later, where we have another huge catastrophic event, and many, many people think that there's another possibility of what they're doing out there, that they killed the Gulf, killed everything in it, so they could build an algae farm out there. So they can actually test a new form of energy, which would mean that they're willing to kill people and kill all wildlife in that whole area to do their testing. And they have bought up some of these, these bio farms. I can't call it a bio farm. It would be just like algae. They've bought these companies up. And the last one in particular, they bought in July, because I happened to read about it. I can't think of the name right now, but there's many, many people thinking that if that seabed floor is not cracked, there's some other agenda in place, and that they really just don't give a damn if they kill people in this process.
Well, and going back to the idea of, this new capitalism, namely disaster, crisis or disaster economics, where
right.
they create a problem and then they're paid to come in and solve it. Jesse Ventura was showing on the show that Halliburton, I think 11 days before the spill, bought up a company that cleans up oil spills.
The Boots and Coots Company, yeah.
Yeah,
and there were several other companies that were bought up like that. Boots and Coots was just one of them.
Yeah, and I mean, people really have to start thinking about this idea of disaster or crisis economics, because I might have the reporter wrong. I think it might have been Naomi Wolf, or one of the big name reporters. I think she even has a book out about this, because they were talking about war. You know, you're paying some of the same companies to go in and and destroy an area, then you pay the company to take care of the troops while they're there, you know, because everything's privatized now, and then you pay the same company, maybe it's just their brother or sister corporation, to come in and rebuild it. So what a sweet deal! I mean, you create the problem and then you're paid to solve it, and it's our tax dollars that's going toward this, and these companies are doing this with no big contracts. You know,
like for instance Kellogg Brown and Root in Iraq. Kellogg Brown and Root brought in the food, brought in, you know, built the barracks. They did all kinds of different things, but they're there in complete support of the troops, while the troops are going out and decimating, you know, the civilian population and spreading depleted uranium around, which to me is just as bad as what's happening in the Gulf. It's ethnic cleansing, it's ecocide, it's genocide. And then you've got Kellogg Brown and Root that are just sitting there. They got the contract because nobody else got it. They were awarded it. That's it. They make the money. They're the ones making out. And what's happening to these troops and what's happening to their families?
Well, and the innocent civilians, too. I remember seeing a report that came out that, again, wasn't in the mainstream media, but was about how Iraqi women and all their stillborn babies, you know.
Stillborn, but deformed. If they're born at all, they're deformed.
Yeah.
I mean, this is from the depleted uranium that they've had almost 10 years out there to spread that stuff around. I mean, I've heard stories where, you know, people won't even eat the vegetables and fruits from different areas like Basra or places like that, where they know that the depleted uranium is just at such high concentrations that the food itself is poisoned. Well, that's what's going to happen here, too, because it's in our food chain. If this stuff is in our shrimp and in our oysters, there's other things that eat that.
Right.
And then it goes right up to our cattle.
Right.
You know,
right.
It goes right up to the chickens and the cows and everything else that people are eating. So, you know, people need to think about that before they sit down at a restaurant like Red Lobster and order a dozen shrimp.
Absolutely.
You know, or chicken breast for that matter.
Well, that's true. I mean, really, I've gotten to the point where I only want to eat organic now because I'm really afraid, you know. And you said Red Lobster. Yes, you know, I recently went to Red Lobster, and, you know, I won't order something that I know could potentially come from the Gulf, you know. I just won't. Because
exactly. And the restaurants.
Go ahead.
Yeah, the restaurants are probably not going to tell you the truth about where it comes from either.
Because you know why?
They
probably get the food cheap. They're probably getting the food cheaper buying it from the Gulf.
Exactly. They want to sell it.
Right,
so they're going to tell you anything. And it's really crazy, but I see on the TV now all kinds of commercials for these chain restaurants where they're huge sale on shrimp, you know. Come in and get your shrimp dinner for $3.99.
Right.
Well, yeah.
We know why. Well, Anita, we literally have 2 minutes left, so we're going to have to wrap this up. I want to thank you for coming on. I know this is a tough subject. It's really hard to talk about. We, you know, it's not like we have an incredible amount of proof to be able to prove to listeners. But, again, go to those websites that you mentioned. Go back to the Ricky Ott interview. She is certainly, credible. You have good credentials. Look at the Jesse Ventura video. Keep your eyes and your ears open, and we just can't be asleep at the wheel. We just can't, because there are too many people out there who want to make a buck and really just don't give a crap about, you know, who gets hurt in the process. I mean, I hate to say it, but we have to be cynical, to protect ourselves. We can't just think, everything's hunky-dory, because it's really not.
I wanted to make another plug for another organization called movetoamend.org. Ricky Ott is a part of this organization as well, about taking corporate personhood out of the way and restoring the Constitution as it was meant to be, you know, for rights for citizens, not corporations. Money is not free speech.
Right.
You know, so if people could go to movetoamend.org and sign on to that initiative, find out if anything is going on locally or in your state, and if there isn't, get something going. Because what we need to do is elect people in office that are not corporate-owned. We need to add an amendment to the Constitution that will not allow corporations to be people.
That's right.
And,
oh,
and
so
we have to do that.
Anita, we got 60 seconds. Your website, HooDood, HOODOOED.com, and you're also on Facebook, Anita Stewart.
Yeah, people. It's HooDood.blogspot.com. I'm on Facebook under Anita Stewart. Anybody can find me. My other website is AnitaStewartSoilAndWater.com, which is my campaign website. I was elected in November with over 80,000 votes for Hillsborough County Soil and Water Conservation Board, so I'm going to do what I can that position.
Thank you, Anita. So. And Ricky Ott has a Facebook page, too, R-I-C-K-I, I believe, O-T-T. So, listeners, we probably have 10 seconds here. Yep, 10 seconds. So I want to thank you for tuning in tonight, Anita. I want to thank you for sharing this. And please tune in next week, listeners. My guest is going to be Michael Cremo, the forbidden archaeologist, and Sandy Spencer talking about the goddess Kali. Thank you very much, and we will talk to you next week. Thank you, Anita.
Thank you, Karen. Bye-bye now.
Bye-bye.